if you're going to tell a war story, it probably shouldn't be about war.
If we'd known our visit Tuesday with David Carr of the New York Times to talk about NBC's Brian Williams would be our last, we would much rather have talked to David about himself.
David Carr is being remembered as one of the finest journalists in the country. He died last night at 58 after collapsing in the Times newsroom. We want to listen to a couple of interviews that we've heard over the years with him. I had the chance to talk to him in October at Boston University, and I started by asking him what he would say to a student who was thinking about going into print journalism.
If there's a student in the audience who's majoring in print journalism, I'd probably tell him to switch to something more forward-looking, like blacksmithing, for instance. We kid because we love, okay? There is very much a place in journalism for the person who can create a 400 to 1,000-word piece of copy that's clean, that tells you something you don't know. That's a fungible skill that will... It's a movable feast that should transport to many different realms. I'm kind of a print bull in part because it's how I eat. It's how I get hamburgers, is working at a newspaper. I do think that there is print value in that it has the ability to convey, you know, if you have an iPad and you're reading something, you see that person like on an airplane or a bus, you know that they've got $400 to spare. But if you see them reading an issue of The Economist, do you know something else about them? I think people will continue to want to, in certain instances, to use print as a kind of intellectual jewelry and a way of showing others.
People all over the country, people in small towns the way that they do now, or people just in New York and Washington and Boston and L.A.?
Well, oddly enough, in small towns, the print press is doing pretty well. If you're running a community paper, the kind that puts your daughter's soccer game in, you're probably doing all right because you can't take a web page and get it up on the fridge, right? When they show your daughter's soccer team, so those guys have done pretty well. Larger papers like us, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, done okay. It's the middle parts that have been really clobbered, the great regional papers that have been really hurt, but you can't count them out. I spent the weekend reading the Boston Globe, which, you know, you heard all this stuff about how deep a hole they were working from. Pretty damn good paper.
What has been the biggest surprise for you in the media and how it's changed? Something you didn't see coming? Maybe even something that if you were to go back now, you wish you would be able to do a story about it before it showed up. But you and others missed it. What would be the biggest surprise?
Almost every week brings things I had no idea was coming. People always, come and talk to us about the future of media. And I'm like, I have no clue. You know, if you said to me a couple of years ago, yeah, Jeff Bezos is going to buy the Washington Post. What? I'm stunned by so much of what's going on. I've kind of gotten out of the future business. I have trouble keeping up with the present.
Well, let's talk about the present then for a second. One of the things that I know from personal experience exists in almost every newsroom is a series of televisions up on the wall showing the cable news channels 24 hours a day. Do you think that they have an outsized influence on the media because they're kind of the video wire service now that we all rely on to keep up to date with the latest of what's happening?
I can't think of a time in history when cable news has had less of an influence on what's going on with the news cycle. Right now, they don't know where to look. The world is ending everywhere you look. So, you know, it's like Ebola, they're going to get you here. Ukraine, things are blowing up over there. We're on the march in Syria. You just have to have your head on a swivel. They don't really know where they're going, let alone setting an agenda. That we're all being pushed around by a ferocious news cycle right now. Pretty dark one, by the way.
Because of the news.
Yeah, the news is crazy right now.
But what about how they're handling it? The idea that all day long we're seeing every tick of the Ebola story, something that, as has been pointed out multiple times, has only killed one person in the United States. Is that lack of context on their part, or is that just the news cycle?
I'm not for fear mongering. I don't look for me to be walking around with a surgical mask anytime soon. But in terms of the, I think for once the media franticness, if not the tenor of the coverage, at least the amount of it is warranted.
David Carr from our conversation at Boston University last October. We're remembering the New York Times columnist who died last night at the age of 58.
And Jeremy, he would tell you he's surprised he lived that long. Mm. He survived a bout with cancer. The treatment and many packs of cigarettes left him with that raspy voice. Before that, in the 1980s, when he was a brilliant and terribly flawed reporter for an alternative newspaper in Minnesota, he sold drugs and did them, especially cocaine. He beat up girlfriends, then fathered twin girls with Anna, his first wife, who was also a drug dealer. The title of his memoir, The Night of the Gun, A Reporter Investigates the Darkest Story of His Life, His Own, comes from an evening that he first remembered as one in which he was so out of control that a friend had to pull a gun on him. But after writing about it, he realized he pulled the gun. That's how bad things got. But he stuck with rehab, raised the twin girls as a single dad, remarried, fathered another daughter, got a job at the Times. In 2008, David Carr came to our studios to talk about it all.
There's two gestures of the book. One is, who is a loser, who is hopeless? 20 years ago, I was on welfare, single parent, on my way to having cancer, chronically addicted, no money. Today, I live in New Jersey. I have a Ford Explorer that runs, a nice dog, three lovely children, a wife I adore. And so it's something about how that guy became this guy and how we shouldn't count anybody out. But it's also about the fact that we only really tell stories about ourselves that we abide. I'd like you to think of me as the person in New Jersey with the nice family and the kids. But there's a whole backstory to that.
Let's just pick up a little more of the backstory. You mentioned the twins, Aaron and Megan. Really hard to read these passages, as your friends tell you bluntly, what that home life was like with two addicts, two little babies, and Anna had two other children, 2 and 5. You know, no diapers, no food. You're paranoid looking out the window. You're still, you know, struggling with addiction. There's that point where you go to a crack house to get some stuff and leave these little babies in the car with their snowsuits on. It's so hard to read this. How hard was it for you to go back and honestly write it?
The chronology is when Anna and I were still together and both using, that my sort of Joseph Campbell moment came when I left the kids, parked outside that house, and I came out and resolved never to be that man again, put them in temporary foster care, sobered up, attained custody of them, and raised them pretty much by myself. I did end up getting married. The reporting of it was a little embarrassing, I would say, to go back to people and say, do you see that huge scab on your shoulder from when you knew me 20 years ago? Do you mind tearing that off? And, oh, by the way, I'm going to videotape you while you do it.
But and write a book about it and talk
write
about
a book
it
about it.
Yeah.
The writing of it, not so much. I acted as if I were writing about someone else, so I tried to be fair and put everything in context.
But it's not, just so embarrassing. I mean, it's embarrassing, but it's also painful because I know what happens. I know that the two girls have grown and are wonderful young women. But in the moment, I'm thinking, somebody pay attention to those kids. You know, you had friends who...
Let's be clear about this. From the time they were 1 year old, I put them first. I was on welfare. I had no money. I earned my way back into civil society. I raised them by myself, even though I had cancer at the time. There's a heroic aspect to this that, while you find the backstory sort of appalling, there's a lot of uplift here, and it's about, unless I was willing to be straight about where I came from, the things that I did with the help of dozens of people, this village that Hillary Clinton talked about, lifting and pulling, and it's a remarkable human story in that regard. And people tend to focus on the pathology because that's what is most riveting. But there's a slow, organic miracle in the middle of this book that many readers are grabbing onto. And the fundamental message is not about what a bad guy was. It's about the human capacity for change, how people can come together and create something wonderful in their midst. I don't see it as that dark of a book, but in order to tell a true story, my oldest brother reacted to the book as you did, which is, why are you going to do this? You have a really good career. You have a really good reputation.
And I just said, if I pull out one stick out of this pile, the whole thing will fall down.
Right.
You have to realize I work at the Culture Department of New York Times, and I've watched many of these memoirs come apart. And I didn't really want to end up on Oprah getting my arms and legs torn off. So I didn't cut a single corner. And you
and
know
it's
what
not
it is?
Pretty. It's not pretty.
It's not pretty to have out there, but, you know, I think it's a great story. I'm totally proud of it.
David Carr, speaking to us in 2008, his memoir, The Night of the Gun, one of the lines in his book, I now inhabit a life I don't deserve, but we all walk this earth feeling we are frauds. We'll link you to our full conversations and also to a website that's gathering David Carr's many quotes.
David Carr died last night at the age of 58.